Chapter 27. In September of 1984, the roof fell in. By then I was back at Bookbinder's as assistant manager, selling Cabbage Patch dolls and porcelain Michael Jackson figurines as fast as we could stock them. It was my idea to have the store wired for a stereo system and turn us into a Ticketron outlet. Mr. Bookbinder shrugged and put up with a thumping beat. Customers were clogging the aisles. "Smart girl," he shouted over the music one afternoon, squeezing my arm. "You belong in college." The roof fell in figuratively, not literally. Literally, it was the ceiling that gave way. My English 101 teacher down at Ocean Point Community College was the one who finally taught me the difference between literal and figurative. A simple concept, once you were ready for someone's explanation. English 101 was the first class I took. Though I kept pushing Mr. Bookbinder's tuition money back at him, it kept showing up in my coat pocket at the end of the workday. He seemed to want my college education as badly as Ma had. "Well, how was it?" Roberta asked me after my first night class. "I'm quitting. That's how it was." She took the nail polish from the drawer and sat down in the chair next to me. I shook the bottle and uncapped it. "Why?" "Hot pink, hot pink," I said. "I'm sick of this color." "Why are you quitting after one night?" "Because I hate it. I'm not cut out for it. First we had to sit around in a circle and tell people about ourselves."
"What kind of stuff?"
"Jerky stuff, like where we'd like to travel and why we were taking the class, what we hoped to get out of it. I was the last one he called on, and by that time my whole throat was paralyzed."
"Maybe you're right," Roberta said. She was looking at her toes, flexing them. "Next time I'll get red, paint them up like a hooker."
So I started to tell them about our trip up to Canada and how we always mean to get back there and never do. But then I stopped halfway through. Everyone was looking at me funny.
"First night jitters," Roberta said.
I put her foot in my lap and dipped the toenail brush. It always amazed me, the way she could let me touch her feet without screaming, the way anyone could. "The teacher wants us to call him by his first name, as if he's our friend instead of someone who could flunk us."
"You know what I would have said if I was there? I would have told him, 'You name the place, and I'll go there.'"
I sucked my teeth. There's this punk rock woman in the class with her head shaved up the back, 6 or 7 months pregnant, minimum. And this guy who's so huge, he couldn't even fit in the desks. He sat on the floor during the whole class. All I could think of was when I was so fat in high school. It was depressing.
"You're going to let one fat guy chase you away?"
He wasn't fat. Huge, like a giant, I mean. I bet he's almost 7 feet tall. The punk rock woman says she's taking the class because she wants to write this science fiction screenplay where astronauts get lost in space, and by the time they get back, there's been a nuclear war, and everyone's primitive again and worshipping statues of Boy George. People are killing each other for meat, and Boy George is God. Roberta threw her head back and laughed. I haven't done homework in over 15 years, and this woman's writing a screenplay. She paints her toenails black.
"Black," Roberta said.
She looked down at her own feet, considering.
"Takes her shoes off during class, puts her feet all over the furniture, had this bumper sticker stuck to the back of her jean jacket. 'Is your washroom breeding Bolsheviks?' Whatever that means."
Roberta's laugh turned into a cough. The brush wobbled. I put her foot back down on the floor and got her a glass of water. "The stupid textbook cost me $24.95. If I keep taking courses at this rate, I'll be 42 before I even graduate."
"How old will you be by then if you don't graduate?"
"Easy for you to sit there and make jokes," I snapped. "You didn't have to sit for an hour and 15 minutes having to go to the bathroom. We have this essay due next week. Write about an everyday task you perform and your emotional attachment to that task. What am I supposed to do? Put down how wonderful it feels to make toast for breakfast? What a bang I get out of painting your toenails pink? Roberta didn't say anything. I could feel, rather than see, her smile. I lifted her foot off my lap and started up the stairs.
Hey, I got 3 painted toenails and 7 regular ones.
Yeah?
Well, life's a shit sandwich, I said. Deal with it.
The ceiling fell that night. Well, the next morning, actually. Somewhere around 3 a.m. It sounded like guns at first. Caught in that place between dreams and waking, I thought, oh my God, someone's downstairs shooting Roberta. Then there was dust up my nose, more gunshot blasts, her voice yelling up the stairwell, get me the hell out of here before I get clobbered. I put the stairway light on just in time to see another plaster chunk let go. It smashed on the floor near the bed, scattering in 1,000 directions. I ducked and covered and ran in to get her up off the bed. Another slab fell. I felt like a soldier at war. There were 6 home repair companies listed in the phone book. From the hallway phone, I pleaded my case to wives and answering machines. Whenever they put me on hold, I eyed the exposed wooden slats where the plaster had let go, a kind of ceiling skeleton. Mike of Mike's Home Repair gave free estimates.
$950, he said.
Roberta banged her walker against the floor. Jesus H. Christ!
Why don't you just shove a gun in her ribs?
Okay, $875, but no finish work. Take it or leave it.
Leave it, Roberta shouted.
At the exact second I mumbled, take it. She was the one he heard. The guy from Superior Homes wanted $1,050. He told me he'd noticed on the way in that I needed a new roof, too. That if roofs had alarm systems, mine would be ringing. A new roof? How much would that cost?
El dinero grande.
How much in American money? I said.
Big bucks. I got this cousin who...
get out of here, Roberta shouted. Later that afternoon, she supervised while I stood on the top rung of the swaying stepladder and pulled out the sagging plaster chunks that threatened to fall next. We decided we'd live a while with the holes. It was Roberta's idea to approach Johnny Wu, the owner of China Paradise, about part-time jobs. I sat across from her at the restaurant, stirring my vegetarian egg drop soup and rolling my eyes. Look, I said, I already have a job and go to night school. I don't have the time.
You can make the time, she said. What you can't make is enough money for a new ceiling.
When Johnny passed by our table, she grabbed him by the tail of his tropical shirt. For someone with Parkinson's disease, she could manage a pretty quick snatch.
You Chinese guys are smart cookies, she told him. What's your slowest night of the week here?
Monday, Johnny said.
Why? Because my brain's working overtime, that's why. Have a seat.
Her idea was for Johnny to declare every Monday night Polish night, hiring her as the master of ceremonies and me as the disc jockey.
You could give Polacks a 10% discount. Check their driver's license if you didn't believe them. Half this town would turn out, especially if they heard I was here. Believe you me, we could throw a party.
Johnny kept smiling and shaking his head no. This Chinese restaurant would ruin the ambiance, I said. My teacher had used the word in class that week. I'd looked it up.
Okay, then, Roberta said. How about this, her and me running a weekend delivery service for you?
What do you mean?
I mean people call in an order and we drive it out to them.
Roberta, I said, It was like I wasn't at the table.
See, I'm a people watcher, Johnny boy, and every week I come in here and watch the same thing. People out there by the register, rushing in for their takeout in their sloppy clothes, afraid they're going to see someone they know. Or if their food ain't ready yet, they sit in them squishy little chairs by the coat rack, trying not to touch knees with the person sitting next to them. Home delivery. You're throwing away a gold mine, ain't he, Dolores?
Without waiting for my answer, Johnny reached in back of him and drew up a vacant chair.
"Keep going," he said.
We worked Friday and Saturday nights till 11, Sundays till 6. Johnny got us a desk and a separate phone line and paid for the auto body people to yank out the Biscayne's back seat and install a warming box. We paid for the CB radio ourselves. It helped us save on gas. Roberta said dispatching made her feel like she was back in show business. For her CB handle, she resurrected her old radio name.
Polka Princess to Sweet and Sour. Got your ears on? Over.
The jargon embarrassed me, but she wouldn't answer if I just said, "What do you want, Roberta?" And I couldn't afford stubbornness. The Biscayne was getting 9 miles to the gallon.
10-4, Princess. What gives?
Over.
If you ain't been out to Hillcrest yet, come back to Paradise for a poo-poo and 8 immortals crossing the sea. Over.
I hear you, Princess.
Over.
Now we can certainly understand the step-by-step process of your storm window washing system, Roy told one of my classmates. By about the third class, it got easier to call him by his first name. He was sitting Indian style on top of his desk, reading excerpts from some of the class's problem papers. You see, the exposition is clear, but as yet there's no emotional quality invested in this piece. There's no feeling there, none that I can detect at any rate. The student handbook mentioned partial refunds for early withdrawals. I decided I'd quit as soon as we got to our 8:45 break, hopefully before he got to my paper. But when the others got up and headed for the snack bar, the punk rock woman, Allison was her name, said,
"Hey, feel this."
"Excuse me," I said.
"Quick, you'll miss it."
She lifted up her sweatshirt and put my hand on her belly. Something bulged out, poking me.
"Oh, my God," I said. "First 3 months she had me puking my guts out. Now she's into gymnastics."
"She?"
"Yeah, I'm 99% positive.
I'm naming her Isis. Like it?"
"Isis?"
"Yeah, it's pretty.
My boyfriend's in a band. Wants to name her Cacophony, but I said, uh-uh.
I'll name the ones I carry, and you name the ones you carry," I told him. A bump moved across her big belly, a foot, clearly. After break, Roy read aloud what he said were the 2 best papers in the class. The first one was mine. I'd written about painting Roberta's toenails after all, about how holding down those foot tremors in my hand as I worked gave me some sort of power over her disease. In Roy's voice, the idea didn't sound quite so stupid. The other paper belonged to the huge guy who sat on the floor during class. "My whole life used to throb like a toothache." That was the first sentence. It told about how he cured middle-of-the-night insomnia by tiptoeing into his son's room and watching him sleep. How he regulated his own breathing to his son's. How the son would kill him if he knew. "Let's have a hand for Dolores and Thayer," Roy suggested. The applause rattled my heart. I couldn't look up, so I looked over at Thayer. He was hard to figure, sitting back there in his own outskirts, those sequoia legs bent up at the knee. I snuck peeks for the rest of that class and the next one, gradually noticing things about him other than his size. His hair, for instance. A mop full of blonde curls so tight you could stack coins in them. His beard was reddish-brown. Going in and out of the classroom, he had to duck to miss whacking his head. His step had a bounce. Those curls rose and fell as he walked.
"Thayer?"
I said. We were in the corridor on our way out to the parking lot. Hearing his name spoken seemed to alarm him. "I just wanted to say I really liked your paper. The one Roy read last time?"
"Sounded pretty ridiculous next to yours," he said.
But his face made me glad I'd risked the compliment. "Can I tell you something? You should try sitting closer to the rest of us. You miss a lot by sitting apart like that. It sets up barriers."
"How do you know?"
Heat rose to my face. "I don't know. I just think it must. This is my car."
"You're really good at description," he said. "When Roy read your paper, I could practically feel her foot in my own lap."
"You could?"
"Yeah. Which was a real turn-on because I have this foot fetish."
I unlocked the Biscayne, got in, locked it again. He was talking at me through the glass. The trouble with those little squirt cans of mace was that you had to rummage in your purse for them while the pervert waited. I rolled the window down a millimeter or two instead.
"What?"
I said, "Maybe you'd like to go out for a coffee sometime."
I told him I was pretty busy.
"That was just a joke, you know, about me having a foot fetish. Actually, I think feet are kind of ugly."
"Oh."
"I was just trying to be witty. Happens when I get nervous. Sorry."
"How old is your kid?"
"How did you know I had a kid?"
"Your paper.
You said you watched your kid sleep?"
"Oh, yeah,
right. 13. Pain in the butt age. Not that he wasn't always one. I notice you don't wear any wedding ring."
I shoved my hands in my jacket pockets.
"I'm divorced," he said, "if you're wondering."
I rolled my window down some more. "The reason I know you miss a lot when you sit apart in class is because I used to do that when I was in high school, at a table, because I was fat." His laugh was one edgy note. "Not that you're fat," I said. "You're big-boned. I was obese. But anyway, I really liked your paper." I sat in the Biscayne with the motor racing and watched him walk away. My hands were sweaty on the steering wheel. I wasn't sure why I sat there and stared instead of just reaching down and getting out of neutral. He unlocked a van and got in. The whole vehicle leaned toward his weight. He waved as he drove past me. "Existential drywall," the van said. "Responsible work for authentic individuals." It would surprise you, the number of people who crave Chinese food on Christmas Eve. Roberta had had dizzy spells that day, so I was running the takeout service myself. Mr. Pucci's order was one of the last to come in. The dinner for four special. I was nervous driving over there. "Merry Christmas, Mr. Pucci," I said. My tote box was brimming with brown bags. I shifted a little and almost dropped his entire order. "Is that Dolores?" he said. "Oh, my God, you are the last person. Do you have time to come in for a drink?" "Oh, well, not really. I don't want your stuff to get cold." "Half a glass, maybe." The dining room table was set like something in a magazine. Men were talking and laughing down in the sunken living room. I followed Mr. Pucci out to the kitchen. For a couple of quiet seconds, we just smiled and took each other in.
"How long have you been working at the restaurant?" he asked.
The cup of cider he gave me was warm and freckled with cinnamon. I told him about my divorce, night school, Roberta.
"Well," I laughed, "here's to the man on the moon."
His eyes teared over, and he shook his head. He looked older.
"Old? Two old friends," he said.
One of the men called up, "The smell of that food is torturing us, Fabio. When do we eat?" I drained my cup.
"Is that Gary? I'd like to say hi to him," I said. "Wish him happy holidays."
"Well, he's been sick. The flu." I watched a nerve jump in his face.
"But all right. Come on. Sure."
I nodded and smiled as he introduced me to his company. Handsome Jordan Marsh catalog men come to life in their beautiful cable sweaters and creased pants. The room was sweet with cologne.
"And you remember Gary?" Mr. Pucci said.
I struggled to control my face, to force my muscles to act normal. There was a quilt over his legs. He had become a skeleton. He squinted up at me.
"Who is it, Fabio?"
"It's Dolores Price, honey. She was a student of mine."
He stared without recognition. "I barged in on you once," I said. "You two were going on a picnic. You gave me some cookies and played Billie Holiday on your jukebox." I suddenly noticed the jukebox, pointed to it. "There it is," I said. His shaking was wilder than Roberta's.
"Now I remember," he said, "the big fat girl."
Mr. Pucci laughed and blushed.
"I'm sorry," he said. "He's not himself."
Roberta was up when I got home. I flopped down on the waterbed next to her and stared up at that collapsed ceiling.
"Now I wish we'd gotten a tree after all," I said. "No matter what it looks like in here."
"I know what you need," she said. "You need your Christmas present." She opened hers from me first, a Chippendales calendar we'd sold down at Bookbinder's. We thumbed through the months, choosing our favorites, giggling together at the sexy men. My present from her was wrapped in red foil and had cascades of curled white ribbon.
"It's so beautiful. I hate to open it," I said.
"Red and white," she said. "Pollock colors."
Inside the box was a satin Chinese robe, orange blossoms falling on peacock blue.
"What in the hell are you crying for?" she said. "Come on now."
I took it out of the box and it fell to its full length.
"It's just so beautiful."
"You rat. We agreed not to spend more than $10 a piece. Now I feel even cruddier."
"Ah, go on," she said.
"Johnny down at the restaurant got it for me from New York. Half price."
The robe slid coolly against my skin. We both stroked it. I told her about Mr. Pucci's lover.
"If it's that stuff, it's catching, ain't it? The teacher must have it, too."
"I feel scared," I said.
"I'm sure you can't pick it up just by walking into their house."
"Not scared of that. I'm just scared it's there, that it exists. I can't stop seeing him. He looked like a concentration camp man."
We held hands tight.
"Roberta," I said.
"Hmm?"
"Nothing. I'm just glad you're here."
Thayer Kitchen did the ceiling job for 3 1/4 during our January semester break, moonlighting for a week's worth of evenings. Sometimes I'd watch from the doorway as he hammered and hefted sheetrock or clunked around on his steel spring stilts, whistling along with his Bob Seger and Springsteen tapes. During his break,
He set the stove timer for 15 minutes and flopped back on a kitchen chair. I sat with him, but he did most of the talking.
You see, it's tricky enough now that he's getting hair under his arms, and I'm noticing crusty underwear when I do the laundry. But him being half black, on top of it, makes it a little tougher. Hard on the kid, you know. Lately, he's gone heavy duty into his ethnic thing. Hangs out at the Y with the bros. Gets pissed off if I forget and call him Arthur instead of Jamal. Or Chili J, I should say. That's his rapping name.
What about his mother? Isn't she around here?
Claudia? Lives down in D.C. He stays there for part of the summer, August, usually, but he hates it. Claims all the McDonald's in Washington water down their milkshakes. But I think he gets lonesome. Claudia's got a killer work schedule, so it's pretty much him and the VCR. I mean, we drive each other nuts, him and me, but we're tight. Chili J, my man.
I'm divorced, too, I said.
Kids?
I shook my head.
Yeah, well, he must have been a big doofus.
Who?
The guy who let you get away.
The comment took me off guard. It was several seconds before I heard the droning of the stove timer.
You got a crush on that big drink of water who's fixing the ceiling, don't you?
Roberta said that night. She'd caught me humming Against the Wind while I helped her into her PJs.
Don't be ridiculous, I said. What makes you think that? Because all week you've been walking around here in a daze.
Paint fumes, I said. At the start of spring semester, I reduced my hours down at the store and signed up for two courses, Psychology 112 and Herstory, A Feminist Look at the Past. I don't really want to major in business, Mr. Bookbinder, so it's not fair to keep letting you pay for my courses, I said, pushing back his second envelope of money.
Don't force her if she doesn't want it, Mrs. Bookbinder said. You keep out of this, Ida, he scolded. This is business between the girl and me.
I smiled at the word girl. I was 33. Allison was in my Herstory class, too. By then, she had broken up with her boyfriend, thrown her Boy George screenplay into the wood stove, and given birth to Shiva, a 10-pound baby boy. I visited them one afternoon with a present, one of those snuggle sacks that lets the baby sleep against your chest while you carry on with your life. It cost $39.99, a splurge. But it was the only thing I felt like giving her. Allison and I read the instructions, and she tried it just before I left.
Whoa! It feels primal, she said. Third world or something.
The only man in the Herstory class dropped out after the second week. Some nights, class turned into a kind of group therapy seminar, though personally, I kept my mouth shut. The more my classmates shared their stories and raised each other's consciousness, the more horrified I became with the marriage Dante and I had put together. I looked up existentialism in the library. If I had the theory right, I was just as much to blame for my bad marriage as Dante had been. Roberta's your family, I told myself. She's all you need. Yours is an authentic life. Thayer was taking word processing on Tuesday and Thursday nights. Sometimes we sat together in one of the student lounge booths, but whenever he started talking about new movies or restaurants he'd heard about, I broke in with complaints about my busy schedule. One evening, I spoke out in class. I hadn't meant to. Those women just drew me in. I think... The secret is to just settle for the shape your life takes. My voice hesitated a little, but I kept talking. Everyone seemed interested. Instead of, you know, always waiting and wishing for what might make you happy.
What might make you happy? My professor asked. The rest of the class took over.
Prince Charming, someone sighed.
Small thighs.
My boyfriend finding my G-spot.
Allison hooked her bare feet around the chair in front of her.
Prince Charming locating my G-spot between my thin thighs.
All around me, women laughed and nodded.
No thanks, Thayer, really, I said.
Any reason in particular?
I'm just not seeing anyone.
If he expected something in return because of the ceiling job, that was his problem, not mine. He should be existential about it.
All of which would have been fine if Allison hadn't brought Shiva to class one Tuesday night. She'd decorated the snuggle sack with studs and punk rock buttons. I couldn't tell if the safety pins were decorative or practical.
Psst, she said.
I've got cramps. Can you take him?
The baby warmed the front of me. Watching that little vulnerable gap in his skull collapse and expand with each breath was a kind of hypnosis. The professor's voice blurred away.
Why don't I just hold him for you until after the break? I whispered to Allison when she got back.
Thayer was in the lounge eating a bowl of chili.
Well, he said, smiling at the snuggle sack. I see you've become a marsupial. He got me a soda and, when he returned, bent down and brushed his lips against the baby's head in the exact spot I couldn't stop watching. Allison was at the jukebox, dancing wildly by herself. The following week, my herstory professor assigned me a research paper called The Biological Clocks of Baby Boomers, A Dilemma for the 80s Feminist. Well, assign was the wrong word. I chose the topic from her list of possibilities. In the library, I read article after article, stared at one downward-sloping graph after another once you hit age 35. Down at the store, Mr. Bookbinder started featuring two new lines of clocks, cuckoo and digital. Allison began wearing a series of see-through watches strapped to her arms, their inner workings exposed like X-rays. The whole world seemed to be counting down my remaining childbearing time, or at least I was. In the student lounge, I'd sometimes catch myself staring over at Thayer, sitting in the same booth where he always sat, directly beneath the big wall clock. But I told him no thanks to whatever he suggested, bowling, the stock car races, a home-cooked meal.
It's my size, isn't it?
He said. Of course it isn't. I just don't have the time. Gary, Mr. Pucci's lover, died in March. I hadn't known his last name, and I'd forgotten that he was a travel agent. Since the holidays, I'd been watching the obituaries for their address. I wasn't prepared to have it strike me with the force it did. The article mentioned his relatives, an award from the Chamber of Commerce, a lengthy illness. Nothing about Mr. Pucci. I told myself I was too busy to visit Mr. Pucci. Two jobs, a research paper, midterms on their way. That Powell stuff he'd said at Grandma's wake, about us being connected by the moonwalk. It was just his way of being nice, comforting me. But that was it. He comforted me. I couldn't sleep. I tiptoed downstairs, hoping to regulate my breathing to Roberta's, but her snoring sounded like a chainsaw. Back in bed, I told myself how rewarding it was to finally have a neat, predictable life, give or take a ceiling cave-in. Being in your mid-30s brought benefits, I reminded myself. You began to appreciate tidiness, smallness, things in their place. This is the shape your life has taken, I said. Be existential. Go to sleep.
For the next 3 nights, I drove through Easterly's sleeping neighborhoods, burning up gas and listening to my humpback tapes. Each night, Mr. Pucci's upstairs light was on, a single rectangle of pain. The weekend before my research paper was due, I sat at the kitchen table, index cards fanned out in front of me. Outside, the snow was coming down in fat, chunky flakes. The doorbell rang. Roberta was off at High Li.
"You Dolores?" the boy said.
He was lanky and handsome, with smooth coffee skin. He had a sweatshirt hood pulled over his head and something menacing in the bag under his arm. "My husband always shovels our walk for us," I said. "As a matter of fact, he's putting on his boots right now." I pointed back inside the empty house. From behind the bushes, a voice said,
"She's bluffing. Get going."
It wasn't a weapon in the bag, or a snow shovel either. It was a boombox. Suddenly, Aretha Franklin was singing Freeway of Love, and Thayer was up on the porch. They began a father and son breakdance. The boy, I couldn't remember his name, whirled and spun and managed gymnastic flips all over the snowy porch without slipping once. Thayer was a disaster, grunting and repeating over and over a single graceless maneuver. A miscalculation with one of his clumpy work boots sent three of the railing spindles flying off the porch and into the snow. "Hey!" I protested. At the end of the song, the boy clicked off the tape and began snapping his fingers.
"The name's Jamal, and I'm the best. I got fine ladies hanging off my chest."
"How old are you?" 12, I said. "Give me a break." Thayer had been staring at his son's hand, trying to get his own finger snapping to catch up.
"Yeah, get to the point, doofus," he said.
He was still panting hard.
"This here's Thayer. He's saying a prayer. You'll be his lady. The deal ain't shady."
"My term paper is due on Tuesday, and..."
"My man here's cool. He ain't no fool. Think about you all day. Make him drool."
"All right," I said. "Once. I'll come for dinner once, after I get this paper written. And don't forget, I'm a vegetarian." Thayer smiled goofily and snapped his fingers at me.
"Ain't she sweet? She don't eat meat."
Jamal shook his head.
"He got it bad for you, Mama. He a mess."
I started closing the door. "I'm not your mother," I said, attempting a scowl. "Fix the porch before you go." Back at the table, I couldn't stop smiling at my index cards. I scared Mr. Pucci when I rang his doorbell in the middle of the night. I could read fear in his face, then recognition, curiosity.
"Dolores?" he said.
"I'm sorry it's so late," I said. "I brought you this." He reached out and took the African violet, staring and staring at it, turning it in his hands. Then the leaves and blossoms trembled. When he cried, I folded him up in my arms. During the first of our night rides together, Mr. Pucci and I were mostly quiet. I turned the steering wheel with my left hand and held his hand with my right. We played the whale tapes over and over. "They soothed him," he said. By the end of the second week, we had established a routine that either of us could trigger with a single telephone ring. He waited for me out on his front porch in a lawn chair, bundled up against the cold in his trench coat and tweed cap. The red dot of his burning cigarette was the first thing I'd see. "Hi, pal," he'd say. Then he'd close the door as quietly as he could, and we'd be off. Eventually, he started talking. Not about the way Gary died, but about his beautiful singing voice, the loving way he had with plants, his knowledge of travel. I kept going over to his house, driving Mr. Pucci around in the dark, learning who he'd lost.
In the 18 years they'd been together, he said, they'd split up only once, in 1982, the year they'd both turned 50. The separation had lasted just long enough to bring the unknown virus home. Later, they'd worried about the disease, Mr. Pucci said, but for their friends with wilder lifestyles, not for themselves. They hadn't detected anything for over a year, until Gary's hacking cough refused to go away.
It was amazing, though, Dolores, he said. The more ugly his condition got, the more beautiful he became to me.
I was afraid to ask Mr. Pucci about his own health, his own future. I didn't talk much at all. I listened. Listening to his life with Gary was like taking lessons in love. For my dinner at Thayer's, I wore my black blouse, black pants, and my blue Chinese robe. That afternoon, I'd had my hair highlighted.
Have fun on your big date, Blondie, Roberta said.
It's not a big date, it's a meal. And by the way, this hair wasn't my idea. The stylist talked me into it.
My mistake. Watch out for them paint fumes.
I'd made him and his son chocolate chip cookies. I got into the Biscayne and put the plate on the passenger's seat. Halfway there, I looked at myself in the rearview mirror. You're driving toward a mistake, I started to tell myself. Dante seemed sweet at first, too. Dante drove a van. Learn from your mistakes. But my hair distracted me. It had come out nice. I looked pretty good. For me. They lived in a duplex, just past the caution light on Route 3.
If you get as far as a car graveyard, he'd said, you've missed us.
I inched and spun the Biscayne's wheels up the steep dirt driveway he'd warned me about, dipping and lurching over the frozen ruts of mud. At the crest, I picked up a little speed, then braked hard just in time to avoid running over a turkey that ran in front of the car. The plate of cookies flew to the floor. Just drive away, I advised myself. Instead, I picked up the cookies, brushed them off, and got out. That's when the turkey started chasing me, across the front yard and up the steps. It cornered me on the porch, lunging and pecking. I threw cookies at it and yelled for Thayer. He came out in wet hair and a bathrobe, laughing. Get this goddamned thing away from me, I said. It took another lunge. I beamed it on the head with a chocolate chip.
Some vegetarian, Thayer laughed. She won't hurt you. Will you, Barbara? Besides, you're early.
I am not. You said 6.
I said 6:30, but that's okay.
You said 6. I know you said 6. He picked a cookie off the porch floor and bit into it.
Not bad, he said. A little stingy on the nuts.
He scooped up the turkey in one arm and held the door open with the other. Jamal's over at his friend's house, in case you're wondering. He called in from the bedroom while he dressed.
This way, I can put all my playboy moves on you in private.
Ha ha, I said. From my seat on the couch, I surveyed the way he lived. Stacks of paint cans, stacks of newspapers, an open bag of caramel popcorn on the television. A calico cat strolled into the room and stepped daintily into the litter box, staring at me while it squatted.
Have any trouble getting here?
Thayer yelled in over the whir of his blow-dryer.
No,
I called back. Already my black pants were covered in cat fur.
This is what your life would be like, I told myself. Clutter. Can't win vacuuming. Always having to dump the litter box. Not until I ran into your welcome wagon lady, that is.
Who?
Barbara? She's not ours. Just visits. Wanders down from the farm up the road.
The cat jumped into my lap, circled,
flopped down. I scratched its throat and let the purring massage my fingers. The pants were already a lost cause.
Dinner was stir-fried tofu and vegetables over linguine and a bottle of red wine. Our conversation had gaps. "So, did you get your eyes tested?" I asked him. During break the week before, he'd told me how he was having trouble reading the screen in his word processing class.
"Yeah, I need bifocals. I didn't order any, though. The girl holding up the mirror was snapping her gum. I just kept trying on all these frames and getting more and more confused. It's weird, you know. One minute you're this cool young guy with a Camaro and your whole life ahead of you. The next, you're some old farsighted fart sitting across from an optical consultant who's young enough to be your daughter.
How's the food?"
"Delicious," I said.
It was.
"You were probably expecting SpaghettiOs, right? You love getting involved with me. No kidding. I'm full of surprises. Even marinated this tofu stuff in, hold on a second." He lumbered into the kitchen in his stocking feet, then reappeared. "Tahini sauce, so it won't taste so much like styrofoam."
"My ex-husband was a stir-fryer," I said.
"Drove a van, too."
"What kind?"
"Ford."
"Mine's a Volkswagen."
"How tall was he?"
"How tall? 5'10 and a half, 5'11, why?"
"Well, all these coincidences. Just wanted to make sure we weren't the same person, you know."
He washed the dishes, and I dried. He beat me at Trivial Pursuit. At the car, I let him kiss me. Once. After our second dinner together, we took a long walk on the dark back roads near his house, and he volunteered his past. He'd met his ex-wife, he said, at her dorm in the early 70s, when he was working for a contractor, doing a rewiring job.
"I was fresh out of dog patch, and she was 3 years older. Introduced me to politics. Dope. All that good stuff. I got so into the whole thing, I kind of forgot who my parents were until after we eloped. They wrote me back. They just couldn't recognize a black daughter-in-law. Or a half-black grandson that got started out of holy wedlock. We were embarrassments, see?"
"How long were you married?"
4 years. I was married 9 and a half. If I wasn't an existentialist, it would be real tempting to keep blaming our divorce on my parents. Or the times. Reaganomics.
Reaganomics?
Here's what she wrote in the letter she left. She wrote, "It's not that I don't love you, but that I've somehow outgrown you. My life here has become pot-bound, and it's just such an outrageously opportune time for black women with MBAs." And it was, too, I guess. She makes $65,000 a year. Got Jamal all financed for college. Pot-bound. Like she was a spider plant or something.
It must have been hard when she left. What did you do?
Let's see. First thing I did was whack the shit out of the bathroom wall with a crowbar. Then I sheetrocked it back up again before Jamal saw it. Memorized the pancake recipe by heart. Learned to iron. Jamal was in parochial school then. Used to get notes from the nuns about his sloppy uniforms. After a while, we hit our stride, though, old Chili J and me. Got us some therapy. And we both convinced Claude to drop her custody thing. That's about the time I started going to night school and became an existentialist. Life's absurd. Live authentically. Stop whining. Bam! I got into it.
It must be hard, though, raising him by yourself.
Sometimes.
Right now we got this running battle about him getting braces. He tells me blacks just don't wear them. Says I'm trying to turn him into a straight-tooth vanilla wafer.
I went to parochial school, I said.
And you were fat.
And I was fat.
And what else?
The night was moonless and cold. A clean cold, no wind. I got raped when I was 13 years old, I said. He put his arm around me and waited. Didn't speak. I started with the night Jack Spite tickled my feet and took him through Ma's death, Gracewood, Dante, my life with Roberta. I ended with my aching over Mr. Pucci and my aching for a baby. At the car, at 3 a.m., I said, "So now you know enough to go running in the opposite direction." He told me not to flatter myself, that I didn't scare him half as much as I thought I did. He asked when we could see each other again.
Why?
Because the other day I kicked over a whole gallon of latex semi-gloss thinking about you. I'm lonely. You've memorized your ex-wife's farewell letter, I said.
What letter?
He said.
What ex-wife?
Mr. Pucci began to talk about the AIDS, the way death had taken over Gary's life, their life together. By then, he had begun inviting me in for herb tea and some of whatever I'd baked for him. His tea kettle was the kind that seeped silent steam. Curling-edged snapshots of the two of them were taped all over the kitchen cabinets. "Is it any easier now that it's over?" I asked. He looked at me a moment, considering the question.
"It isn't over," he said.
"I still need him so badly, 100 times a day. The other day I was looking for something in the bedroom closet and got an unexpected whiff of him from one of his sweaters. His face crumpled up, but he fought off crying. The pain is almost physical sometimes. I missed him so much that day that it gave me a bloody nose. Just started bleeding for no reason. Hadn't had one of those since I was a kid." I took his hand, tracing a vein, my fingers warm from the teacup. "Maybe it'll get better once you get back to work," I said. "You're good at what you do, all those screwed-up kids." He smiled. "I'm not sure I can keep doing it. Pump them up with my messages of hope, my belief in their promising futures." One night near the end, it was worse at night for some reason, I got up to check on him. He wasn't in bed, and I got so scared. And then I noticed the floor was cold. The whole house was. The back door was open, and I found him out in the yard, walking in circles around the car, and I put my arm around him and led him back inside. "What the hell were you doing out there?" I said. "Don't do that to me ever again," I was angry at him. "I mean, we lived in fear of his getting a cold, or..." He just sat in the chair, couldn't stop shivering, even with a blanket around him. He'd been out there in his bare feet, so susceptible for God knows how long. And he looked up and said, "Clear as day," he said. "Nighttime is when it feeds on me, Fab. Listen. You can hear it." He cried then. Hard, strangled barks and snorts of pain. His face against the table. His arms a frame around his head. When he was quieter, I walked down into the living room and over to their jukebox. My finger ran down the choices, and I thought about how love was always the thing that did that, smashed into you, left you raw. The deeper you loved, the deeper it hurt.
"Putting rain in my eyes,"
tears, tears in my dreams, and rocks in my heart.
The music made him look up. He stared at her singing. "Billie Holiday," he said. AIDS wouldn't have surprised her, Dolores. "Typical," she would have said. "Par for the course." That was when I got the strength. "Do you have it?" He didn't answer until the end of the song. Then he smiled. "I'm HIV positive." "That means?" "It means it's in me, waiting. Deciding if it wants to bloom." The third date with Thayer was my idea. I had a plan. We had arranged it after class on Thursday. The long winter had cracked that day, and a warm breeze had blown all afternoon. People were in shirt sleeves, tossing each other frisbees in the mud. "I'd like to bring you to the beach on Saturday," I said. "I'll get takeout from the restaurant, and we can take a long walk. Pick you up around noon."
"Orchestrating the whole thing, eh?" he laughed. "I got a date with Arthur Fiedler."
But by Saturday, the weather was cold again. Wind blasted along the shore, flinging prickly sand against our faces. The surf sounded mean. The beach was unwalkable. I'd parked squarely in the middle of the empty 1,000-car parking lot. The food out of the warming box was lukewarm.
"You know this song they're playing?"
Thayer asked, nudging his chin toward the radio.
"It sounds familiar," I said. "Life in the Fast Lane. The Eagles."
He sang along a little.
"Yeah? What about it?" "First time I heard it, I couldn't get what they were saying. Thought they were singing Flies in the Vaseline."
I didn't smile.
"Yep, that's us. Life in the Fast Lane. So anyway, you seem a little off today. Something the matter?"
Looking straight ahead, I made my proposal. Waited. "Well," I said finally, "I can see by your silence that I've made an idiot of myself." I started the car.
"Hold on a second, will you? Shut this thing off. I just didn't see it coming, that's all. I've got to think about it."
I cut the engine.
"All right,"
I said. I got out of the car and walked the perimeter of the parking lot. Walked it a second time, faster. I got back in the car. I knew what his answer was from the way he consolidated the takeout containers and put all our mess back in the foil bags. "Just do me a favor and forget I mentioned it," I said. "Just block it out."
"The thing is," he said, "I spent half a year trying to get you to go out with me, and then, pow, just like that, you want me to help you make a baby? I'm not sure you realize how hard it is, raising a kid by yourself. Sure, it sounds romantic, but..."
"Oh, bullshit," I said. "This isn't some impulsive whim." I started the car again, gave the engine a few revs.
"I mean, lend you my sperm? Takes a little getting used to."
"Just forget it, really. I'll take you home."
"What's in it for me?" he said.
"I don't know. Free sex. You want popcorn afterward? A blank check?"
"Don't be a wise ass," he said. "I've got a right to ask about it. Then there's Jamal to consider. I mean, do I tell him about this or not? He'd have a brother or sister out there, half, anyway."
"No, he won't. It's a bad idea. Just forget it."
"See, I like the idea of giving you something you want so bad. And the sex part, that's got its appeal, too. But I don't know. I'm not sure I could do it."
"No one's asking you to.
You've got to admit it's pretty heavy duty, fathering a kid you're not going to raise.
I just wish I kept my mouth shut. He turned on the radio, tapped his fingers against the seat, turned the radio off again.
Okay, here's what I'll do. I'll think about it for a week. If you promise to think about something, too.
What?
Having a baby the regular way. Getting married.
Thanks, anyway, I said. It wouldn't work out. He brushed his hand against my wet cheek. I wanted so badly not to be crying.
Why not?
It just wouldn't, that's all. It never works out. Don't love me. Flying sand scratched against the car. I blew my nose. I had the sensation we were parked there for the rest of our lives, that we'd erode before we drove away.
You're overheating, Thayer said.
I'm perfectly calm. I just wish I hadn't even said anything, because now every time...
No. I mean your car's overheating. Your radiator.
We better get going. Fine, I said. Go.
You're driving,
he said.